Hi, I'm Diana Gabaldon. I would be Gabaldon were we speaking Spanish, but if we're not, it's speaking English, it's Gabaldon, G-A-B-A-L-D-O-N, rhymes with stone. Anyway, I am a writer. I write big, fat, weird, indescribable books, as we've been talking about. And this is the first one, called Outlander. And as my beloved first editor used to say, these have to be word-of-mouth books because they're so weird you can't describe them to anyone, which is absolutely true.
Before we even start, though, we've got to continue with what you just said. You write these indescribable books that can't fit anywhere. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
Well, let's put it this way. This is my first book. I wrote it for practice. Right. And that being so, I didn't think that there was any necessity for it to be a particular kind of book. I decided originally to write historical fiction because it seemed to me that would be the easiest. I could look things up instead of making them up, and if I turned out to have no imagination, I could steal things from the historical record, which actually works very well. Yeah. But so I started with historical fiction. By the third day, I had introduced a character who turned out to be a time traveler, and everything kind of went by the board after that. To this point, I have seen these books sold with evident success as literature, fiction, which are sometimes the same thing, sometimes right. not. Historical fiction, historical nonfiction. This is true. I once found my books in the
historical nonfiction, in the
history section of Foyle's bookstore in London, and I pointed this out to the clerk, and he said, "Oh, well," he said, "Miss Kitty Foyle, who was still alive at the time, but about 92, said Miss Kitty decides where all the books in the store go. She's read your books, and apparently she believes in time travel."
That's too wonderful.
Well, you try to make the history as accurate as possible.
Yes.
So let's see, historical nonfiction, science fiction, fantasy, which are in fact separate things, but often sold similarly, mystery. Each one contains a complete murder mystery, though people often don't notice with everything else that's going on. Romance. Let's see. Gay and lesbian fiction.
Right.
And horror.
So, let me just get this straight. Every genre is represented except the one that you have all your degrees in.
Oh, that.
Science.
Science kind of flows through them all.
Okay.
Yeah, no, people always say to me, well, how do you get from being a scientist to being a novelist? And I say, well, easy, I wrote a book. But, you know, that's all you have to do.
Yeah.
But what they really mean is that they think that science and art are different things, and they're not.
Right.
No, they think that science is this very cold, linear, logical, tidy kind of thing, you know, and done by people in white coats and nerds with pocket protectors, and, you know, it's not something that your average person can be expected even to understand, let alone be interested in. Whereas art, well, you know, it's all touchy and feely and warm and colorful, and anybody can be creative.
Yeah.
They can. They can't be saleable, but they can be creative.
Right.
And so they say, well, this is accessible to everybody, you know, so how do you get from this to this?
Yeah.
It's the same thing. I said art and science are two sides of the same coin. What they both rest on is the ability to draw patterns out of chaos.
Ah.
That's what it is. It's
nice.
Pattern delineation and perception. When you do scientific work, you essentially settle on a question, a hypothesis. You say, I see these things taking place. This is observation. This is how you define your and delimit your chaos.
Mm-hmm.
You say, I see this taking place in this system with this organism or, you know, in this pathway or whatever. And so automatically you've limited your chaos. I'm looking here, and I think this might be what's going on. I think I see the hint of a pattern. So let me form a hypothesis about this that can be tested. And this is the heart of the scientific method, which seems to escape a heck of a lot of people who call themselves scientists these days. You have to have a falsifiable hypothesis. That is, a hypothesis that can be proved wrong. Okay, the so-called climate change scientists,
right.
They can't do that. What
right.
they're doing is not science. Yeah, don't even get me started. Let's see. But anyway, you formulate a hypothesis. You then carry out your experimental design, which you've thought of, and with any luck, that will, in fact, bring the pattern into close focus so that anyone else can see it and replicate your work and see the same pattern. Okay, so that's your experiment. You then write up your results, you publish them, and other people can replicate them. But there's your pattern delineated. When you do something like a novel or any other work of art, but let's take novels since
sure.
that's what we're working here, you delimit your chaos by your choice of subject matter, setting, and your own persona, because any decent novelist is using a lot of themselves in the work. And So you have this chaos going on. Now your novel is in fact your hypothesis. This is the question that you're asking. The theme of your novel is the question. And often, for me at least, the theme doesn't emerge until I'm pretty far into the novel. Other people think you have to have one to start with and find if that's how it works. But your experimental design is the shape of the book, the structure, how it takes place. And again, for me, that's a gradual process. I don't plan it ahead of time. Other people do. But then the book emerges. And for me, it's like assembling an n-dimensional jigsaw in my head. I don't write with an outline. I don't write in a straight line. I write where I can see things happening. And as each little scene is completed, and I don't write and rewrite, I just write and I fiddle with it continuously as I go along. So by the time I've finished with a scene, I will have been through it literally hundreds of times, and it's as good as I can make it right then. Well, if I know what happens next, I'll write that. If I don't, I go write somewhere else where I can see something happening. And gradually, all these little pieces fit together in this shape that's emerging. And when I see the shape, then I have the book. There's still pieces to be done, but I will know what that book is about. I'll know for sure what my hypothesis is and what the experimental design is. The novel itself is the pattern, and good luck. It can be replicated. That is, other people can read it and get out of it all of the various things that I put into it. They'll get out other things as well. You always will when you, and that's one of the minor differences between science and art. But even science will do that. Science will stimulate new ideas on the basis of what you've delineated there. Likewise, a novel will ring different bells for people depending on their background, their prejudices, their expectations. People who read one of my books expecting a romance are often in for a rude shock.
Well, I have to tell you that I'm staggered at your having demonstrated a quantum concept of Heisenberg's principle of the observer influencing the outcome of the scientific experiment.
Oh, it always does,
doing.
Yeah. That's exactly what's happening. Yes, thank you.
Staggering. So
it's impossible to talk about writing without using metaphors, because people who don't do it, they have no idea how the process works. And in fact, a great many people assume that if you are a writer, you're born as a writer, and you therefore have this stack of stories sitting in your head, and all you have to do is sit there and type. Just why they're always writing to me and saying, stop writing this, stop writing that, I only want you to write this, So, not how it works. Now they think writers are sort of like an artistic Pez dispenser, and you just tap them on the head and they spit out a story.
An artistic Pez dispenser is storyteller.
I do, yeah.
Well, you said at one point that you knew you were always supposed to be a novelist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why?
I don't really know. I was born that people say, do you think you have to be born as a writer or storyteller, or is it something that can be learned? Well, you can totally learn the craft of writing. I can teach anyone how to be a better writer. I don't know that I could teach someone to be a storyteller who didn't have it, and I don't know whether you can learn that because I was lucky enough to be born with it. It's entirely possible that you can learn that. I just don't know. But I've always been able to see what I call the other side, and just sort of step through that wormhole into what's not unreal life, but it's not here. So you were asking me about stories and my youth and all that. No, I have a sister to whom I'm very close. She's almost 3 years younger than I am, but we shared a bedroom for most of our childhood, and we would tell these long, interactive, continuous stories at night after we went to bed, over and over, it was always different stories, but each of us had sort of a handful of stock characters, and then we'd add others as we needed them. My sister can do this, too. She doesn't, for various reasons, but she's a lawyer, but she's just as good at it as I am.
When you were young, were you much of a reader?
Oh, yeah. No, I can't remember not being able to read. I'm told that I could read quite well by myself at the age of 3. Mm-hmm. And my mother taught me to read by reading me stories, and including Walt Disney comic books. Uh-huh. So, in fact, I've been reading Donald Duck and Uncle Scrooge and so forth since I was 3, which is what led me later to write for Disney in my late 20s.
Nice. Was there any particular writer that you can think back to that just really captured your imagination or ability to see inwardly?
Oh, dozens of them, yeah. See, this is the thing. People always say, well, who is your favorite writer?
Yeah.
And I said, look, I'll be 60 in 2 weeks. I've been reading since the age of 3. I have hundreds of favorite writers. You know, I can tell you who's the most recent favorite writer that I read something. Yeah, that would be Phil Rickman, whose Secrets of Pain I just read. Wow. Wonderful book. Wonderful guy. Thousands and thousands. But casting my mind back to my childhood, I basically read my way through the Flagstaff Public Library. And I can remember a number of books and series. I liked series even then. So, you know, there was Danny Dunn and his Time Machine, which, in fact, don't have anything to do with the time travel in my books. But it was a popular series. There was one about Zip Zip, the boy from Venus. There were, I think, only three books in that series. Huh. But interesting. Yeah, adventure books is what I liked. The Trixie Belden mysteries. I really was not much into Clara Barton Nurse and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But some of them. I read all of the biographies for young people. You know, there were two series, the Orange series and the Brown series, about different people, which I found fascinating as well. Huh. And, you know, earlier than that, I was reading Alice in Wonderland. I read that one, you know, repeatedly in my youth. And The Swiss Family Robinson, which is a great story, even though made up, you know, with once you have a scientific education, you can't read it without laughing anymore. Yeah. But you know, as a child, it was great. Perfect stuff.
The connection that you're hinting about here between the writer and her craft and the reader and their expectation. There's a symbiosis there that may not be healthy, other than obviously it is healthy in some respects.
Well, I wouldn't call it a symbiosis in that I don't actually depend on the readers. We might call it synergy, I suppose.
Okay.
But my son is also a novelist, by the way. He writes fantasy under the name Sam Sykes. And, it's hilarious. But, you know, we talk about writing. One of the things I told him early on when his first book was published, he was getting me all kinds of commentary and so forth. And, you know, I told him, for one thing, I said, never, ever read your Amazon.com reviews. I said, just don't. I said, even the good ones are just grossly irritating. And the bad ones will just, you know, cause you to go around in a state of, you know, homicidal rage all day. I said, you know, don't do it. Of course, he didn't listen. he was worrying about it. And I said, look, Sam, it's this way. I said, there's nothing but you in the book. I said, you don't owe these people anything. You know, you can write a book, and if it's a good book, and it's the sort of book they like, they'll buy it. That'll be great. I said, but you don't owe them the book that they want to read. I said, you can't write with the reader in mind. You can't write with a million readers in mind. If you expect to have more than one reader your entire life, it's obviously a non-starter. You can't do that. I said, therefore, it's you and the book. Your only loyalty is to the book, because if you allow your attention and your allegiance to be fragmented in that way, you won't write an honest book. It won't be a good book. I'm not saying that it wouldn't be a saleable book. There are a lot of people who, you know, pander to their readers, you know, blatantly.
Yeah.
And again, I name no names. And it's a very successful thing to do because they're fulfilling the reader's expectations. But see, they have a different view of what they're doing. They think they are in a business to fulfill people's expectations. Mm-hmm. That's not what I think.
Mm-hmm. When I was reviewing your advice on characters...
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's one of the questions I've asked some of the writers we've talked to. Do your characters come to life in your mind?
Oh, sure.
And do they then take over ever?
Oh, sure, all the time. It's a great gift when they do. You know?
Right.
Now, for me, characters, and I'm sure you've seen this, fall into three categories. I have onions, mushrooms, and hard nuts.
Right.
Yeah, the onions are the people whose essence I apprehend immediately. I know who these people are in their heart and soul instantly. But the more I work with them, the more layers they develop, the more pungent and rounded and vivid they become. And Claire and Jamie are both onions. I've worked with them for a long time, but I continue to discover new and interesting things about them because, you know, people are endlessly fascinating. And the more varied their experiences, the more unusual sometimes their responses will be. I have never liked the kind of character who, you know, from page three, you know exactly how they would meet any challenge whatsoever. It makes for a very predictable book.
Two-dimensional.
I'm just not interested. But, and consequently, people in my books often do, you know, quite unexpected things. And I'll have people writing and say, oh, that's so out of character. And I'm saying, no, it's not. I say, it's not what you expected, but it's certainly in their character. And if you want to listen, I will explain to you why. And sometimes they do and sometimes not. But those are the onions. The mushrooms, those are the good ones that you were talking about, who just pop up out of nowhere. I'm not expecting them. I didn't plan for them. They're just there. And they invariably walk off with any scene they're in. You know, they talk very easily, too.
Can we talk a moment about the way you write?
Sure.
I mean, do you use pen and pencil or quill? You obviously must use a quill pen.
I have written with a quill just to see how it goes, you know, and it's very slow and tedious.
It is.
But, yeah, I would rather not.
And forces. Beautiful penmanship.
You know, you're taking your time because otherwise you're not going to get enough ink on the page. It does. I always work on a laptop, sometimes a desktop. We've had many computers, personal computers in the house since 1980. Mm-hmm. My husband's business used to be custom programming for PCs and all that. And so our first home computer was a Victor 9000 with the dual operating system, Dawson CPM.
Yes. Yeah, so you work on a laptop. That.
Well, I kind of have to. Mm-hmm. I can't see my sentence unless it's on the screen in front of me. I can see things. Mm-hmm. But see, this is the curtain between the writing and the craft, is that you have stuff happening. You perceive these things. You get emotions, and you get facial expressions, and you get action and words, and that's all coming at you. The way I describe it, like I say, it has to be metaphorical, is there's me, and there's this big field with a lot of interesting people doing fascinating things. But between me and them, there's a sheet of plastic. And in some places, it's, you know, like saran wrap. It's very clear. I can see everything, I can hear everything, and I just have to pick and choose. You know, how am I going to describe this? Am I going to focus on this person? Am I going to look at the person in the back? Am I going to, you know, mention the birds flying around back there, or are we just going to look at the body in the foreground? You know, and other places the plastic is sort of smudgy and like 3 mil tarp, and I can still see people moving. I can tell what the action is, but I'm only getting half sentences. I don't see the faces, so there's more intuition there. And in other places, still it's like a garbage bag. It's very black. It's opaque, it's thick. I can just see shapes bumping against it, and I get the occasional word coming through, but I have to get up really close and feel with my hands and, you know, and guess a lot about what's going on over there.
Nice.
Yeah, and sometimes the plastic will fade out or fade in its opacity. Yeah. But, you know, once I've got whatever I'm getting from there, then it's a continuous process, because the back of my mind is also kicking through the compost and asking questions all the time, and more little pieces come clear to me as I do. You know, I'll be saying, you know, what time of day is it? How is the light falling? It's coming in low from there. It's late winter afternoon. Why is it winter? The light is blue. I've got that blue tinge to it. Okay, it's late winter afternoon. The light is coming in low. It must be around 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I started this particular scene with a whiskey glass. That's what I do on what I call a cold day, a day when I have nothing in mind. I knew how to write yesterday, but today I have no idea. So I'll flip through my research materials until I come up with a kernel. That's a vivid image, a line of dialogue, an object, anything I can see or sense concretely enough to write a sentence about it.
Strong visualization, isn't it?
Yeah, though sometimes, as I say, it's a line of dialogue rather than a visual image. It can be an emotional ambiance as well, but anything that I sense very concretely. Yeah. And then I write a sentence about it, and I sit there and stare at the sentence, and I take words out, and I put them back, and I move the clauses around, and I write another sentence, and then I change them around. I fiddle endlessly, back and forth, trying to balance that sentence and make it as clear and euphonious as it can be and as accurate for what I'm trying to describe. And all the time, the back of my mind is kicking up these questions. How is the light falling? So I was seeing this late winter afternoon light falling through my crystal goblet, which was incised with thistles. I picked it out of a Sotheby's catalog of 18th century Scottish crystal and silver. And so I was writing something like the late blue winter light, that's too many adjectives, but keep going, fell through the crystal goblet, the thistle inside, no, that's too many adjectives, we'll do this thistles later if we need them. The light fell through the crystal goblet, I need the blue light of late winter afternoon, that's better. Fell through the crystal goblet, casting it's falling on the table, it's casting a pool of light, casting an amber pool of light, I can see it, it's distinctly amber, on the polished wood, that's why it's looking amber, it's on polished wood, now it's looking like amber because the glass is full of whiskey, well now I know where I am. I'm in Jocasta Cameron's parlor because she's the only person in this story who would have a glass window, it's not in a cabin with an oil deer hide over the window, and who would also have a crystal goblet incised with thistles on a polished wood table. So I'm in Jocasta's parlor, and so I'm thinking, okay, well, it's winter. Are my hands cold? Yes, they are, and so is the end of my nose, but my feet are warm. Why is that? Oh, there's a fire. There's the fire. Oh, there's a dog by that fire. I've never seen him before. That's how it works.
You just did the most brilliant rendition of actual writing.
Yeah.
The inside of the mind of the writer that I've ever seen.
It's the only way to do it.
We can go home now.
Well, it's either metaphorical or you've got to give people the blow-by-blow.
That's beautiful.
Oh, well, thanks.
Is there a particular time of day or anything else that hits when you write, or do you just
It depends. There's sort of a rough shape to my day. Partly, it's changed somewhat now. You know, when you have kids, your day is shaped around your kids to a certain extent. But I've always been a night person, and, you know, I would always, as I say, stay up late telling stories with my sister. And for years, I would get up and sit on the edge of my bed at 7 a.m. going like this and thinking, one day, as God is my witness, I will not have to get up at 7 a.m. And this is the greatest perk to being a novelist, is you can work when you're actually awake, you know, and not when everybody else thinks you should. And, so anyway, I like to work in the middle of the night. And when I had small children, I had two full-time jobs. I was a research professor at Arizona State for 12 years, and I also was writing freelance for the computer press almost full-time because we needed extra money, and I could do that without leaving home. Consequently, I would work at the university 3 days a week. I was a research professor. I didn't actually need to be on the premises all the time. And then I would work in my home office the other 2 days. But I did most of the writing for that job and for the freelance writing at night, you know, after the kids were
done. You carried a notepad for those moments of inspiration?
If I write anything down, it's gone. It goes right out of my head the minute I write it down. And I may never find that piece of paper again, so I don't. No, when I have a bit of information, I crystallize it in a very vivid visual image, if I possibly can. Right. It's harder to do that with an emotion, but it can be done. Right. I don't forget those crystals. They're like those little Japanese things that you drop in hot water and you get Godzilla. Yeah, so I that's all I do is pack it into this little crystal, and then when I get to my computer for the next round of work and let my mind relax, then that crystal will unfold for me.
I have to ask, you have your blog and website that is addressing future writers and prospective writers, or writers who are wanting to perfect their craft, and they're giving some great advice on timing
Speaking of timing, take as much as you want.
do you teach classes?
I do periodically, not on my own, but there's a writers' conference called the Surrey International Writers' Conference. It takes place in British Columbia every year, and I've done that for the last 19 years. I really enjoy it. I like the people. It's beautifully organized, and I like to teach. Teaching is the only thing I miss from academia, really.
Has technology changed the way you write, or can you envision technology changing the way books are produced, written, and social media as part of that technology?
Starting at the beginning there, it doesn't change the way I write, other than making it logistically easier. The reason that I always write on a computer and instead of longhand and so forth is because I can't write fast enough to keep up with what I'm thinking. And even though I write very, very slowly, it's that I change things all the time. As I described, I'm changing the flow of the words, and I'm taking things out. And if I did this in longhand, it would be so crossed out and delineated with arrows and things like that I wouldn't be able to read it after the first 5 minutes. Whereas if I have it on a screen, I can change it as often as I want, and it'll still be legible. And likewise, when I write, there are always little things that kind of drift down through the scene. You know, I'll keep pushing these little bits out of the way, and sometimes they come up on one, and I think, yes, here's where it goes, or I'll move it back up, and I'll think, yes, that's where it goes. And at the end, though, I'll still have this little handful of phrases, sentences, sometimes paragraphs. Those are my orts. Exactly. And so I'll just kind of leave them there until the next phase of assembly, when I begin putting these scenes together, when they begin to stick to each other, and at which point I'll start developing chunks. Well, when I do that, then the orts will drift down to the bottom of this big chunk, and eventually they'll get cut off and put into an outtakes file, where I mostly never look at them again. But sometimes I'll go back and drift through there, and I'll turn up, you know, these little bits of nugget, you know, little phrases or bits of imagery, or just, you know, the hind end of an idea that was just kind of lurking in the weeds there, and be able to get something out of it.
Nice. But,
The technology and so forth. What it's mostly been valuable to me for is in selling books, because there's a great difficulty when you write books that cannot be classified. And it's much, much less now that the internet allows you to classify a book as six different things at once. I fought with Barnes & Noble for 8 years to get them to take my books out of the romance section, because, well, what happened was this book, Outlander, unlike any of my other books, it actually has a traditional courtship story as the underlying skeleton. It has a whole lot of other things that you would never find in a romance. And believe me, when they published it as a romance, you would believe the screaming from the romance community, as they put it. But anyway, my agent called one day. They'd had the book for 18 months. They'd given me a 3-book contract. I was working on the second book. No idea how long it took to publish one, so I wasn't worried or anything. He called and said, well, they finally decided what to do with your book. He said, it's a hardcover, softcover deal. So the hardcover is not a problem. It will just go up front with all the other hardcover fiction, as being long before the days of big box stores. And he said, but for the paperback, they think they'd like to sell it in as romance. I said, as what? I said, you know, I like well-written romance, but I've certainly read enough of it to know that's not what I write. And I said, you know, I got two problems with this. You call it romance. I will never be reviewed by the New York Times. Right. He said, I can live with that. That's a good thing, because they never have reviewed me. And
is
I said,
right?
Oh, yeah.
We have to change
like
that.
They would. It's not only popular, but it's also romance. Yeah, but I said, I can live with that. I said, what I can't live with is the idea that this would cut off the entire male half of my readership. I said, you know, men see different things in these books than women do, because they're men. And I said, I would hate to lose that. Yeah. Well, he was a man. He said, yes, I understand. He said, we could insist that they call them fantasy or science fiction because of the weird elements. He said, but bear in mind, a bestseller in SFF is 50,000 in paperback. He said, a bestseller in romance is 500,000. I said, you got a point. Sell it as romance. Because I believed what my editor said. These have to be word-of-mouth books. And I said, that being so, it makes much more sense to expose them to 500,000 people who all go out and tell their friends than to start with 50. Is that once people have read it, it becomes perfectly obvious that it's not, you know, what you were thinking. And in fact, most people just go and grab their friends and say, you have to read this book so I can talk to you about it, rather than try to describe what it is. But that being so, you know, there's all these problems with selling a book in bookstores. And as I say, Barnes & Noble then shoved them into the romance section for the next 8 years, in spite of the fact that the publisher our agreement was I would allow them to sell them as romance, provided that we had dignified covers, you know, no man hair, no bosoms. And that if the books became visible, meaning hit the New York Times list, that they would then reposition them as fiction, which they very honorably did. You know, Voyager hit the Times list in hardcover. They immediately put fiction on the spine, you know, removed the roses from the front covers, and fine. Except that Barnes & Noble said, well, your first book was a romance, so everything you write for the rest of your life is a romance, as far as we're concerned. So I was on a book tour with Lord John and the Private Matter and kept finding this in the romance section in Barnes & Noble's. And finally one day I was at Half Moon Bay doing San Francisco area signings.
I'm from there. That's my home.
Yeah, okay. Well, I finally had it, and I called my editor and said, look, I've had it. I'm not going into another Barnes & Noble as long as they're putting my books in the romance section. You know, cancel the drop-in signings. I'm not going. And she did. So I had a free afternoon, and so I spent it walking up and down the beach at Half Moon Bay, you know, thinking about this.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had been talking to district managers and store managers, and all of them said, well, we've read the books, yes, we understand, but it's a top-down corporate model. You know, the head office tells us exactly where we have to put books, and we cannot move them. And so finally I said, I got nothing to lose here. And so I went home and I wrote this rather rude letter to Steve Riggio, who was the CEO of Barnes & Noble at the time. I said, dear Mr. Riggio, I'm assuming you may be familiar with my name as it pops up at the top of the New York Times list every time I have a book out. I am assuming you may be familiar with my books. They're those extremely large bits of historical fiction that take up an entire bay of your bookshelves. I said, I'm assuming also that you've heard of a bookstore chain called Hastings, which is, you know, a smaller chain. I said, they're not Barnes & Noble, but they ain't chopped liver. They've got 250 stores east of the, or west of the Mississippi. And I said, I do think, though, that you may not be aware that Hastings sells 40% more of all my books than you do. And I said, I do assume you'd like to know why that is. I said, well, I'll tell you, Steve, they're not putting them in the effing romance section.
Do you have confidence in the future for writers and publishers?
Oh, yeah. Well, see, on the good side, the ease of access and all this means that many, many more people will try.
Right.
Whereas beforehand, when you just couldn't get published unless you could pass that that barrier into a mainstream publishing company, a lot of people, you know, they would maybe try, but they never got past the slush pile, so no one ever saw what they were writing. Now they can at least make it available, you know, and depending how hard they want to work, they can get people to read it. Now, whether it goes any farther depends on the quality of the work, as it always has, but there are at least many more means of access available to them. And for those of us who are established writers, we now have this rather interesting alternative to our mainstream publishers.
Yeah. you have just been a fountain of inspiration and knowledge.
Words, at least. You know, I could talk all day.
and we could, but we have less than 1 minute of tape left in this machine.
Well, that'll put a stop to it, which is too bad. I've enjoyed it very much.
Oh, it has been fun. Thank you so much.
My
thanks
pleasure,
for sharing.
Entirely. Oh, thanks a lot.
And we look forward to working this interview for people to see, because I know you'll be as exciting in person as you are in your books.
Well, thanks very much.
Thank you. Yeah.